Hello again, everyone, and welcome to it. It's the Daily Daily Caller Podcast for Friday, the 28th day of November. No, wait, the 29th day of November. Look, I'm still on a trip to Fancoma. It's the day after Thanksgiving, and I'm also overdosing on sale prices. It's Black Friday. I'm Derek Hunter. I'm your host. Thank you for listening, downloading, tuning in, telling a friend, doing all that good stuff. This show only exists because you guys listen to it. If a podcast happens in the woods and nobody downloads it, does it really exist? Nay, I say nay. It is an interview show, and we've got two interviews for you today that we've sat down in the past because it's a holiday. It's not officially a holiday, but I took the day off, so meh. So we're running two interviews that you may have missed if you're new to the program, and you should hear again if you're old to the program. The first one is a twofer. Two best-selling authors, well, they're of the same book, Carrie Severino and Molly Hemingway, about their book about Justice Kavanaugh called Justice on Trial. And then we're joined by my buddy Dan Gabriel to talk about, he's a former CIA official, been in the field, all that good stuff that you really want to pick his brain over beers over. And we talk about his amazing documentary, Mosul and the War on Terror in general. Both are fascinating. Both are very interesting. Mosul, I believe, is streaming now. You can check that out. And Justice on Trial, you probably already have because everybody seems to have bought a copy. So forget that book. Go buy a copy of my book. Yeah, there you go. Go buy a copy of my book, Outrage Incorporated. So, yes, they're going to be played back-to-back, and I'll be back to wrap it up at the end of the program. If you want to enter to win, by the way, a signed copy of Rich Lowry's book, just email me, Derek, D-E-R-E-K, at dailycaller.com. Otherwise, you can wait until next week. The drawing won't be until next week, so the winner won't be announced till next Friday. So you've got a week. I just thought I'd throw that in there. But first, a word from our lovely sponsor, CBD Oil from AncientLifeOil.com. I take it every day, just a little bit under the tongue, does the trick. The strain, the sort of low-grade eye strain that you get after hours of working on a computer, it's gone. The little aches and pains in the joints where you're like the muscle strain, it's an amazing thing. Don't take my word for it, though. It is word. It's my word. I put some of it under my tongue every day now. It's part of my daily routine. Search for yourself. Search CBD oil benefits. See what people are saying. Read the reviews. Read the critical reviews. Read the articles. And come to your own conclusion and just give it a shot. That would be my only suggestion. Give it a shot with the best organic CBD oil out there. It's not going to get you high. It doesn't contain THC, so don't worry. It's a minute amount that you couldn't even find. It will not impact you. You could chug the whole bottle and you wouldn't get high, but it will make you feel better. A little goes a long way. And if you don't want to try it in your mouth, AncientLifeOil.com also has a topical. So if your elbow's hurting you, elbow's been bugging you, maybe you got a little tennis elbow or punching elbow or whatever you did to your elbow, try the topical. You'll see and you go, oh my God, this is working on the outside so great. Maybe I should try it on the inside. It works, though. See why hundreds of thousands of your fellow Americans are getting into this and believing in this, and why it is popping up everywhere from the grocery store to the gas station. And then get the best. And the best is available only at AncientLifeOil.com. Enter promo code Derek at checkout. You get 10% off. Boom. There you go. Now, ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, or a don't, it is Molly Hemingway and Carrie Severino on their best-selling book, Justice on Trial.
All righty. Hello again, everyone, and welcome to it, the Daily Daily Caller Podcast, the Friday video edition. As we do always, we thank you for listening. Thanks for watching. However this is getting into your head, we appreciate the hell out of it. And as we do every Friday, we bring in real people from their lives who've done things that are much better than we could ever aspire to and ask them, pick their brains, find their knowledge, and we have two today. So we got double the pleasure. We're joined by Molly Hemingway and Carrie Severino. And I pronounced it?
Severino.
Severino. I have dyslexia, so I can claim that as an excuse. The new book, I'm just going to go and declare it a bestseller. Justice on Trial, The Kavanaugh Confirmation and the Future of the Supreme Court. Congratulations on the book, first of all. I have to know, before we get into the substance of the book and the drama that was the confirmation, How'd the book idea come about? Which one of you came up with it?
Well, so we knew this was one of the most important things that happened to the country last year, and we both knew that there were real stories there that hadn't been told. So Molly was covering it as a journalist. I was working on it more from the inside from a group that was trying to advance the nomination. And we knew there were important stories out there to be told, and finally decided to team up because it really, I think, maximized both of our strengths knowing it. We had a lot of access to some of the key players as a result of what we had the work we had done before, and that meant we could talk to people like the president and the vice president, people in the White House counsel's office, many members of the Supreme Court. We had dozens of senators and their staff, and then people that knew the Kavanaughs or people that knew Christine Blasey.
You did more than 100 interviews for this.
Oh yes, hundreds of
hours.
We
interviewed more than 100 people. Many of the people that we interviewed, we did many interviews with each of them.
And so multiple hours of interviews. Yeah. Really.
So how do you sit down and it was a huge drama. How do you decide? How do you whittle the list of people? And who surprised you the most that they said, yes, I'll sit down with you. You talk to Supreme Court. You talk to the President of the United States. I mean, when you send that request out, you think, oh, you got to do it. You got to check that box, blah, blah, blah. And you get the call back. The President is willing to sit down with you.
So it was such an interesting work of reporting, and I am the reporter. Carrie doesn't even have that background, but she turned out to be
the Judicial Crisis.
I just had a very intensive apprenticeship in reporting over the last.
She did an amazing.
Get away as quickly as you can.
I'm on the other side
life.
Of the microphone, so it was a neat.
But no, she did an absolutely amazing job, and part of it was just about we did know because we had been involved in it. We already knew who some of the key figures were, and we did talk to some of them first to kind of lay out a general overview of what happened and what we're going to want to get into. But every single interview that we did. You would get these little breadcrumbs about who else you might want to talk to or who else might have a good story. And so it was just about taking our core team and then people that we wanted to interview and then building out from each of them. And the thing I really liked about it is people will tell you their perspective on a particular thing that happened. And as enough people tell you their perspective, you start to get a really, it's like that tale of the elephant being described from different angles. You start to get an idea of what's happening in a way that people don't even intend to tell you the details.
The Jeff Flake compromise.
So, right. That's where, and it happens in this anteroom outside of the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing room. And you have all these senators that are packed into this tiny space. Some of them are secreted away in the tiny bathroom. You've got Jeff Flake and Senator Coons wrapped up in this tiny phone booth trying to negotiate everything. And then outside of those, in the hallway, but still in the room, it has a hallway and a little thing.
Oh, I've
You've got people
in the Senate. That's a mess.
You have people actually nearly coming to blows in anger over some of the shenanigans that have been
deployed. Staffers or Senate?
Senators.
Senators.
So there are staffers that are in there. The senators are constantly trying to get the staffers out, but there's no room for them to go. And outside of the room, people are trying to get in. So it gets up to be like 100 degrees. And when we first heard people talk about it, we thought, this sounds absurd. And by the 20th person that we talked to who was there was like, this just sounds like the craziest thing that's ever happened.
And when you've got dozens of people there, there's a lot of different
right,
of
yes.
that story.
And so what was the most surprising? What did you learn while doing this?
It's hard to even, there's so many really fascinating moments. I would come home at the end of the day and be like, I can't believe we learned this.
Yes.
I think one of the things I really enjoyed was getting to see the human side of the Kavanaugh family. It was really even starting from the beginning when they're being chased by the press. And remember how everyone was camping out in front of Amy Coney Barrett's house, and they're camping out in front of the Kavanaugh's house too. And they decided, they didn't even know if he was going to get the nomination yet, but they said, we just have to leave the house. So they actually had to sneak out through this backyard path. They hid their clothes in the neighbor's treehouse so no one would see them leaving with suitcases or something, and then just camped out in a friend's house for the duration, not knowing yet even. They packed what they would need if they had to go to the White House for an announcement, but didn't even know yet. And then, of course, following it through, just the trauma of learning about the allegations, how you carry on your life. I mean, you've got these two girls in school, bringing them to school, trying to make sure that there aren't any outbursts there. And the surrounding community was incredibly supportive, actually. Obviously not all on the same political side.
Right.
I think it was a wide variety.
I used to live in his neighborhood when this all happened. I was like, he must live down there because it's just a mess.
Well, and really that whole, I mean, it's amazing how consistent the community has been over the years, because there's people who live there who they all went to high school with, and that it's still very much a local story because everyone is there who knew them both growing up.
There, Mrs. Kavanaugh, did they want this? Did he want this? Did Mrs. Kavanaugh want this? You have to know that this, especially now, especially under President Trump and the way that the left has been acting since Election Day or even before, that anybody he picks is going to get a hellstorm. The nomination of Brett Kavanaugh, the other justice whose name eludes me.
Merrick Garland?
No, not Merrick Garland.
Neil Gorsuch. Yes.
Was relatively calm, although the Republicans, the Democrats made the nuclear option necessary. But otherwise, it wasn't a circus. But you had to know that this one was going to be different. It was replacing the swing vote on the Supreme Court. How much did Kavanaugh want this? How much did Mrs. Kavanaugh want this?
We get into that in the book,
Injustice on Trial.
And it is one of the things we did learn was that Ashley Kavanaugh actually prays that Brett Kavanaugh will not get the nomination. She knows he's the most qualified. She supports him on that grounds. But it wasn't even about it being a Trump nominee. It was just that they had gone through this process twice before, and it had been absolutely brutal. During the George Bush administration, he was nominated for the court that he served on for 12 years, the D.C. Circuit Court, and he had to go through that confirmation battle twice because he didn't make it through the first time, and he had to be renominated. And he had a lot of his Democratic senators who were frustrated because he had served on the Whitewater Council, and they were still angry and sore about that. And so they had found that process to be particularly difficult. Brett Kavanaugh kind of took it as he didn't expect it, that he would be the nominee. He knew that he was so close to the Bush administration that that might be a problem for President Trump. So he just had the attitude, I will put my best foot forward. I will answer every question. I will do the best work I can. If I'm not chosen, I'm not chosen, but I'm going to put all the effort into it.
Why was he chosen over the others? There were other people who were thought, Amy Coney Barrett, that's clearly the one. Mm-hmm. Why was Brett Kavanaugh the ultimate choice?
Well, one of the interesting things we learned in doing all the research for Justice on Trial was that actually his name is mentioned well before this nomination. In fact, before Trump was even elected. He was one of, if you recall, the day that Justice Scalia died, there was a Republican debate, and Trump really shocked the nation by standing up there and not just saying, I want to, with whatever Republican presidential would-be nominee has said, well, I will appoint people in the mold of Justice Scalia and the mold of Justice Thomas or who love the Constitution. He actually got up there and gave names. And he said, I'd appoint someone like Bill Pryor or like Dianne Sykes. And people said, did he just name check? And actually, Kavanaugh's name had been mentioned in this discussion he had with his White House counsel, Don McGahn, over who would you name. So that was really interesting. They didn't choose to mention him at the time, partly because he was in D.C. They were trying to focus their campaign on people who were not on the coasts and kind of real America. And that was where Pryor and Sykes fit that mold perfectly. And partly because also the connections with the Bush White House. But it was someone that was always in the back of their minds as this guy is a real stellar person and someone that came up a lot because he wasn't on the first list or its expansion that people would say, now, wait a minute, here's someone who really ought to be on this list. And he did ultimately add him to the list in November 2017. He was someone who had not just a long record in the D.C. Circuit, and that's something that any Republican president nominating someone now wants to see. They've kind of learned from David Souter, who famously came on as a total blank slate and then turned out to be one of the most liberal justices on the court. So we want someone with a record. We want someone who can articulate originalism. But one of the real distinguishing factors of the Trump list and those kind of nominees is it's someone who also has had opportunities to stand up in difficult cases and to make their mark. This isn't someone who's going to just keep their powder dry or try to keep their beliefs secret. And Kavanaugh really had that. He had some very impressive decisions on his D.C. circuit. So in one of the strongest Second Amendment cases that there had been, which is actually in a follow-on to the famous Heller case that the Supreme Court decided, he had some really strong cases about the overgrowth of the administrative state, which is a big focus of the Trump administration, where you've got these administrative agencies with no supervision, out of control, out of the constitutional system. And he had written some cases that in the D.C. circuit meant being in dissent. But his theories and his concerns about the separation of powers actually were that of ultimately adopted by the Supreme Court. That was something that was really impressive, that he stood up for those principles and then also was able to articulate in a way that they were ultimately vindicated by the Supreme Court.
Molly, you look like you wanted to add
No,
something.
I was going to add some of that, but you got it
I've
in there.
Got
so.
It all in.
Well, let me ask you this about the President of the United States. I assume he didn't have any relationship prior, probably never met Brett Kavanaugh before the nomination. During this process, what did the president think of Brett Kavanaugh?
Well, as we're interviewing people, we learn more about who stayed strong throughout the nomination process and who did not. And one of the things that is intriguing, given recent Republican White House handlings of these things, is the one area that the Kavanaugh team never felt they had to worry about was the White House. Partly that was about Donald Trump. Partly that was about Don McGahn, the White House counsel. They were just steadfast. They understood that there would be bumps along the road, that there would be problems, that there might be, you know, a last-minute smear campaign of some kind, but they were steadfast. That was not the case necessarily with senators. Some of the senators were quite helpful in advancing the nomination. Others were not. But as far as President Trump, he made his decision, and he did not agonize over the decision, but he definitely thought deeply about the decision. He had a bunch of really good finalist candidates. So in a way, he could have picked any of them, and mm-hmm. they would have been fine. But he goes with his sense that it needs to be Kavanaugh. And once he makes his determination, he is steadfast with it.
Take us into the thinking of that second hearing. We'll get to Blasey Ford in a second. But the hearing was a media circus. It was a disaster. The Republicans had the prosecutor asking the questions to begin with. Then there's that moment that every conservative remembers where Lindsey Graham suddenly says, enough of this. I'm reclaiming my time. And he just rips. I've never seen that passion from Lindsey Graham before. That seemed to change the tone, not only of Lindsey Graham forever since, but of every Republican who came after him, who did the same sort of thing to a much less degree. Mm-hmm. What was that moment like for the people that were participating in it that you spoke to and the people around that circle? Was that the moment that it clicked or what?
Well, one of the really fascinating things is that we learned is how the transfer of questioning happened with Rachel Mitchell to the senators. Because at the time, it wasn't really clear that is she going to ask all the questions of Kavanaugh, too? How is that going to happen? And so I don't think people knew if it was just that Lindsey Graham was fed up and just said, darn it, get that woman out of here. We're doing this. Or it turns out Mitchell, so she was a really amazing person to learn more about. But she went into this whole thing thinking, I am not here to just convict someone. I want to actually learn the facts here. That's what she does is her job. She is known for doing forensic investigations and understanding what the facts are to determine whether you can bring a case in court or not. So she wanted to be very careful about this. So she disappointed some people in not being as gung-ho as they were hoping, but ultimately brought out a lot of inconsistencies in the facts that turned out to be crucial to some of those undecided votes who were all important. But she didn't have a lot that she could do in terms of questioning Kavanaugh, because if he says he wasn't there, and there's not a specific, you know, there's not that much of a specific date, so you can only go so much into, Well, where were you during the entire summer of
82?
And my gosh, of all people in the nation who actually know where they were during the summer of 1982, Brett Kavanaugh has a pretty, it was amazing. I'm sure people are going, really, I can't believe we picked the one guy to pull this on that has calendars in detail. But, you know, so she knew you can't fill up a half an hour with just that. So she really only had a few questions for him and then was getting ready to hand it over and they didn't even go through like who do I look at? So she kind of, right before it was Graham's turn, happened to be looking over, and I can't remember if she connected eyes with Grassley or with Graham, and just kind of indicated, I'm done. And then, boy, he I think, after watching this, and after being someone where his policy, and was really one of the few left among the Republican senators who said, I'm just going to kind of vote for everyone, as long as they're marginally qualified, you know, I mean, I'm sure he would say more qualified than that. As long as they're qualified, I'll vote for them, right? And he said that in his thing. He's like, look, I have been reaching out to you guys for decades. He voted for Kagan. He voted for Sotomayor, as he says. He voted for all of them, and there's no reciprocity. In fact, the Democrats were incredibly poorly behaved in this whole process, from hiding the allegations, from the way they were playing politics behind the scenes that we also, you know, go into a little bit. So that was something that I think he just was feeling for so long watching it, that exploded there. And I think it tapped into things that a lot of other Americans were also feeling and kind of made them have permission to express that frustration as well.
Yes, but it wasn't just that he'd been slimed that day. He'd been slimed for weeks leading up to it, and there had been no defense of it. You know, nobody had defended Brett Kavanaugh except for the guy who runs the committee, Charles Grassley, at the beginning, and when the testimony opened. And nobody had been defending him for weeks as his name was being dragged through the mud through all these media stories that were lacking substance, were lacking evidence, and yet the media narrative was just running wild. So when he comes out, well, first when Kavanaugh delivers his testimony, but then when Graham does this thing, cathartic is exactly how I would describe it, too.
How it was unprecedented for a Supreme Court nominee to give a media interview, but he sat down with Martha McCallum. What was the thinking behind that? Where did that originate from? Was the White House briefed ahead of time? What, tell us the story behind that.
Right.
That was pivotal.
Yes, it is. I'm glad that you know that this has never been done before. There were so many things that happened in this confirmation battle that had never been done before. A Supreme Court nominee being on TV to give an interview, I mean, it's just something that
it's
decades
hard enough
ago.
To get a Supreme Court justice for an interview, let
well,
alone
that would,
a
yeah.
nominee.
Decades ago, Supreme Court nominees wouldn't even address anything. It was really a testament to how bad the situation was that the team felt that an interview was necessary. They realized pretty early on, you've got, yes, he did his hearings a few weeks, or, you know, by that point, a few weeks prior. Not that many people were paying attention. Most of the narrative was about the chaos of those hearings. Then you've got weeks of unending smears again. So they knew they needed to get him out in front of the American people just so people could remember who he was and see him on his own terms and not as the media were describing him. But we do get into it in Justice on Trial about who the different people were who were trying to get that nominee, why they ended up going with Martha McCallum, how people predicted that interview would go and how it was at odds with how she actually did do a pretty tough interview. And then also what they learned from it. At that time, Judge Kavanaugh was getting different conflicting advice from different people that were in his friend set or group of advisors. And we kept hearing people say that there was this Bushy approach and there was a Trump approach. The Bushy approach, by the way, the people who were saying these things were sometimes, they would speak against the Bush approach, but they themselves had worked in the Bush administration. So it took us a while to figure out that what they were really talking about was an attitudinal approach. So the Bushy approach would have been to just constantly talk about how much you love women and how helpful you've been to women and talk about Christine Blasey Ford's bravery and coming out and telling her story. And the Trump approach was you fight back to defend your honor. And so he's dealing and wrestling with these different pieces of advice. When he sees how the Martha McCallum interview goes and when everyone sees how that goes, they understand that that approach is not going to cut it. So it ends up being a very pivotal moment, not just to get out some new important information, such as why he knew he had not sexually assaulted someone in high school, because he was not sexually active in high school. That was actually very important information that undercut the claims that were being made, but also so he could see how different styles play on TV.
Well, his opening statement was allegedly rewritten by him the night before the Blasey Ford hearing. And it was very passionate and angry, and he teared up. And I think that was a pivotal moment. It was much better, much different, as you said, from the Martha McCallum interview. Let's talk about Dr. Blasey Ford. I call her Blasey Ford. It's just okay, so I'm snarky. But she allegedly didn't want to be known. She wanted to remain in the background. Yet before she reached out, she disappeared herself from the internet. Why? How? Everybody is online somewhere. When she came out, she was impossible to find. Talk a little bit about the build-up to her and that leaked letter to Dianne Feinstein.
Yeah, that was interesting to see how that went down because, you know, if you or I just decides to go off of Facebook, go off of Twitter, you
can 30 days or something
you can cancel your account, but there are still remnants floating around there on the internet probably forever. This was a very thorough, very professional job of evaporating from the internet. And it was interesting to talk to people who had known her, who had been familiar with her Facebook feed, for example, and said, this isn't the person who is just, oh, maybe marginally a little left of center and just not really politically active. She actually had a very, you know, anti-Trump, very liberal take on things in that Twitter or in her Facebook feed in particular. So that's something that kind of was at odds with the portrayal in the kind of public relations side of this. The other thing that we point out, I mean, no one can tell her what is in her heart in terms of what her real goals here were, because she did say she didn't want to go on publicly with this. But it is interesting that, you know, you have this clear public relations approach to the beginning. And then you also, the first people she reached out to, according to her account, is the Washington Post tip line. And she has some texts back and forth with them. And then when they don't seem to be taking action on it, she actually says, well, I can always go to the New York Times with this. And that of course, lights a little fire under them. But that's not a typical type of behavior for someone who doesn't actually want to go public. And then, of course, the letter to Dianne Feinstein, which, again, Feinstein says she's trying to protect her confidentiality while not mentioning that there are confidential procedures for doing this. There was a whole FBI process that was literally invented for this type of situation. It was created after the Anita Hill hearings with Justice Thomas. So you could investigate claims like this and not just ignore them, but you don't have to create a media circus. You don't have to expose both accuser and the nominee to this kind of public scrutiny. And then the senators can decide whether it's something that actually has substantiation should be followed up on. That is something that she ignored. And, of course, then eventually it got leaked, whether from her office or other Democratic senators, whether from Blasey Ford's own team. We don't know. But it was a very small universe of people who had that letter.
Looking back on it, just your opinions, the circus that followed with Michael Avenatti coming out and everybody and their brother saying, oh, I remember this, and the idea of the gang rape parties that Kavanaugh was running when he was 15 years old, that hurt, I think, the cause. Would Kavanaugh have made it if it had just been Blasey Ford and not the rest of the caboose on the clown car?
I suppose it's impossible to know for sure, but I certainly think that Michael Avenatti was a key figure in advancing Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation, and we spoke with people who were highly involved in the process who absolutely give him credit for helping Brett Kavanaugh get through. When the first allegation came out, there was no evidence in support of it, but it was at least within the realm of possible things that could have taken place on planet Earth. As the subsequent allegations come out, they get increasingly more ludicrous. And so it is worth remembering Michael Avenatti's claim, which he boasted about on Twitter, was that he had a client who had been to a series of gang rape parties where she was an adult, but that Brett Kavanaugh was underage and the victims were underage, that as an adult she didn't report these crimes against children.
And then
she went back.
Yeah, there's a lot of gang rape, but the music's really good and there's free beer.
Excellent.
Like, what? That doesn't make any sense.
Right. And so seeing that allegation and the absurdity of it, although it is worth noting that that was the only allegation that actually had a sworn affidavit with it. So the media like to say, oh, yeah, that one was bad, but these others were good. Actually, none of the allegations were particularly well-sourced, and I think journalists who have integrity should have been a sketch more critical of what they were hearing.
You're looking for a unicorn if you're looking for a journalist with integrity. As a journalist, and as somebody who's worked with a journalist, what would you say was the most egregious fit of journalism that you saw watching this thing unfold and looking back on it?
For me, one of the worst things that I think we saw was related to Michael Avenatti. There are really so many, and this is just one that kind of stands out right now, but NBC News actually had information so Michael Avenatti brought forth this claim, and he said he had a second witness who would support the claims. NBC News knew that that second witness did not support the claims, and they sat on that information. They knew it before his confirmation vote. They sat on it for weeks, only revealing it quietly weeks later.
Did they ever explain why? I haven't seen an explanation.
No, and they don't need to, because our journalists are currently in the business of giving each other awards for their bad coverage rather than firing people or holding people accountable or making sure that they, promote people who are not going to follow into mob hysteria.
Carrie, you've said in interviews that the reason you wrote this is for posterity, the rewriting of the revision of history that is to come. And you referenced the Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill situation. Explain that.
Yeah, so I clerked for Justice Thomas. So obviously this is a story that I'm familiar with, that most Americans who lived through that saw how those hearings played out. And it was really chilling, actually, to see the same pattern be followed again, where there's first they try to defeat him by misconstruing his record, then we have this leaked allegation, then we have a circus of a second hearing. And unfortunately, it doesn't end with, and then he got confirmed and they all lived happily ever after. At the time he was confirmed, 2-1 Americans, male, female, black, and white, believed Thomas over Hill. And ever since he was confirmed, the left didn't just go home. They continued their campaign. They tried to revise history. They tried to, continue to change and shape that narrative. So if you took those polls today, you would not see those same numbers again. The people who knew it and saw it in the time saw what was really happening, but that's not what history remembered, unfortunately. We wanted to make sure that didn't happen again, because we know they're not going home at this point. There's going to be a campaign to make this into, again, the cause celebre of another generation. So getting the facts out there and making sure that we were well-sourced and well-researched in all of them was really important, because if Americans forget what happened here, that's the best way to encourage it to happen again. We know there's going to be more confirmations coming, and if this was what it looked like when you were replacing a swing vote on the court, imagine what it would look like if Trump was replacing, say, Justice Ginsburg or another member of the liberal bloc on the court. It would be out of control, and we need to be prepared and understand what happened so we don't allow it to happen again.
Do you think there are people on that Trump list who look at what happened to Kavanaugh and say, maybe through back channels, I appreciate it. I just don't. There's no way I can go through that.
I have to imagine that there are. It would be weird if people didn't think that after seeing what this family went through. And seeing that it happened with someone like Brett Kavanaugh, who really did have this reputation that was well established over decades, you would have to imagine that it would be difficult for people. We did speak with a Supreme Court justice who pointed out that there are people who, you know, lose limbs in service of their country all the time. And if you're not willing to stand up to a tough confirmation battle, that maybe the court isn't for you. In a way, it is the ultimate test for that courage issue that you brought up that President Trump was looking for. Not just having the right judicial philosophy, not just having the record, but do you have the courage of your convictions to stand through? That's becoming one of the most important issues of our age. And unfortunately, a confirmation process that should have some level of decorum might be the ultimate test of that.
Lastly, for both of you, about Justice on Trial, just tell me what you want people to know from this book. It's a substantial book. Most books are about 100 pages less than, having written one, it's about 100 pages less than this. There's a lot of footnotes, a lot of research. But you have an idea when you hand this to somebody or you know somebody buys it, you hope that when they turn that last page, they go, this is what I want to stick with them. What do you want to stick with them?
Well, one of the things that I was impressed to learn was the level of coordination that was happening on the left. Again, you think this is not just a spontaneous movement that came up. There were groups on the left who shockingly were admitting out loud to having flown people in, to giving them the messaging points so that they were all on the same message.
It wasn't organic. They,
well, one of them even said, look, this isn't chaos.
Touch my pearls.
This is scripted. But a lot of people, I think, assumed it was a lot more organic than it was. And then you had even senators who admitted, were saying things that clearly showed them cooperating with that, saying, oh, wasn't it great that we had Blasey Ford wearing a blue dress to invoke Anita Hill's own teal dress. So I think it's just they let the mask slip. I think we just need to go in with eyes wide open and not be willing to be fooled by another, public relations campaign if this kind of thing happens again.
As this book has been out, we've been hearing from people who've read it and read it quickly, which is really amazing. And I love hearing what they take out of reading this. And they each take different things. If it's remembering about media malpractice, if it's remembering about some of the dirty tricks engaged in by politicians. This is a very personal thing, but my sister was telling me as she was reading it that she was thinking about just how everything you do matters and how just normal citizens, how their votes matter and how we hold people accountable matters. And I think that's a really important thing. You touched on this earlier. If people forget this history, it allows it to continue and to be on guard against it in the future. People who went through the Thomas hearings were on guard for this. People who went through these hearings need to be on guard for what's about to come, and being informed is the first step of a long list of things that we need to do.
Molly Hemingway, Carrie Severino. Said it right.
Yep.
Justice on Trial. The book is out now. They're going to sign these books for you. One for me, two for you. You just have to email Derek@dailycaller.com, put in the message and the subject line that you want to be entered to win it. And if you've bought a copy, send me a screen capture of your receipt and you'll be entered twice. Thank you both for coming in. Congratulations with the book.
Thank you.
I'll ask you what everybody asked me when my book first came out. When's the next one? Not in a hurry.
We did so much in such a little period of time. Yeah, we've been getting that already. It's like, well, let's let this one set for a while.
Let it sink in.
Let it digest. Yes. Live a little. Congratulations on
Thank
the book.
You.
Up next, we have former CIA operative and documentary filmmaker and just a man about town. Good guy, Dan Gabriel, on his amazing documentary about the war on terror and the fight against ISIS and the fight to take Mosul. Check out Mosul. Check out this interview. All righty. Hello again, everyone, and welcome to it, the Daily Daily Caller podcast for Friday, the last day of May. Goodbye, May. I'll miss you. I'm Derek Hunter. I am your host. Thank you for listening. This is the video edition. If you're listening to the audio edition, we're about halfway there. Your weekend's about to start. Fear not. And as we do every Friday, we bring in somebody from their world to tell us about what's going on in their world. And today is no different. We have a fascinating guest, Dan Gabriel. He is the director and executive producer of a new documentary called Mosul about St. Petersburg, Florida, ironically. No, just kidding. About Mosul, obviously, and the fight to reclaim that city from ISIS. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Good to be here, Derek. Thanks
for
having me.
Thank you for coming in. The documentary is, it looks incredible. You don't, our international news coverage in this country is so terrible that I think makes this movie even more important, because you just hear a name, can't find it on a map, don't know why you know that name, don't even know what country it is in most cases. But Mosul is incredibly important. Before we get into that, though, and talk about the documentary, talk about this man's past, which is also fascinating, let's take a look at the trailer for the documentary Mosul, which is available now on iTunes.
كلام السياسيين مو كلام المواطن. ناس تعبت.
طائفية يعني أصعب من السلاح الفاتك اللي هو الكيميائي والنووي.
So, Dan, before we talk about the movie, the documentary, tell us about yourself. You're a former CIA counterintelligence officer. I want to know how you make the leap to documentary filmmaking.
Sure. So I joined the agency as a counterterrorism officer in July of 2003, and I served about 9 years there. Part of the time I was involved in what was going on in Iraq and then later into Afghanistan.
And you were deployed four times, was it?
Two times to Iraq, yeah.
But two times to Afghanistan as well.
Four times to Afghanistan.
Four times.
Yeah.
Six.
Who's
okay.
gotten? but the first deployment that I had, which was between 2004 and 2005, is when I first heard about Mosul. So that's how old the story is. That's how far back it goes. It goes back to 2004. and certainly my experience there was fleeting. It wasn't for a long duration.
What is a CIA counterintel? Is it interrogation?
Counterterrorism. Yeah. So I was not a counterintel guy, and then a counterintel guy would be focused on, you know, Russian spy stuff
right.
like that.
Counterterrorism.
Right. So, you know, at the time, Al-Qaeda 2.0 was basically just starting up under Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, and Mosul was really starting to heat up, as well as the rest of the Sunni triangle. And this is something that was evolving from what we knew as kind of Al-Qaeda 1.0, which, you know, the guys that took down the World Trade Center, which is why I joined the agency, into something more nefarious. And ultimately, Zarqawi, you know, was killed a couple of years later. And Baghdadi, you know, was able to pick up the pieces and start something even more abhorrent, if that's even imaginable. And that became ISIS, as we know it.
Do you think the American people really have any concept of what went on over there in those days? There was a lot more media coverage then than there is now, but it's 2 minutes here, 30 seconds there.
Right.
You obviously were going back and forth for your job, so you got to experience it and see the coverage of it. What would you say is the biggest disconnect between those two things?
Well, let's look at it over the past, you know, 10, 15 years. So, I mean, basically, right now, you hear nothing about ISIS. You hear there's no reporting from that part of the world, at least, you know, in the Western media of significance and of quality. When ISIS took over, you know, large swaths of land in that part of the world, there was also very little video that came out of that part of the world.
Right.
There was some civilian, you know, cell phone camera footage, but that was really it. ISIS actually did a better job of covering their operations than the Western press did. So going back into the earlier days of the war, you know, 2003 to 2006, 7, 8, 9 timeframe, you know, then the media did have embeds with the military. So you at least had that sense of a presence on your evening news where you could have a sense of what was going on. But, you know, it's certainly been the stories that have been told out of this conflict, I think now are coming from documentaries, and hopefully most will be one of them.
Let's talk about, because we knew about ISIS, we knew about Al-Qaeda, we knew about Saddam Hussein and the war in Iraq. ISIS seemed to spring up out of nowhere and suddenly be everywhere over there overnight. The Obama administration, to my mind, I don't know what your politics are, I don't care what your politics are, but from my opinion, it seemed as though, you know, the president referred to them as the JV team. Just because you put on Kobe's jersey doesn't make you Kobe Bryant. You're not an LA Laker. Is that kind of how it was on the ground over there, that they weren't taken seriously? They thought, well, here's just another band of radicals. Or were there other bands of radicals around in various parts and they just happened to get their stuff together first?
Right. Well, look, anybody that was paying attention knew what ISIS could become. And this was the argument that was based around the discussion and the debate on the Status of Forces Agreement that ultimately was not signed. So if you go back to the politics of the day and you look at the debate, it was, do we pull out precipitously or do we maintain some type of presence there? And frankly, the side of the argument that said we should maintain a force there to solidify and build a foundation on what we've spent so much sacrifice and blood on, ultimately turned out that they were correct.
So you leave, by my math, which was not my major, you leave the CIA in 2011. Did some part of you always think there's a story that needs to be told there, and it took you until, because this, your documentary was shot 2017, 2018.
Right.
How does this process come along? How do you get the idea and then actually get the funding and get the footage? Because the footage is amazing. It's not only crystal clear, but I mean, you're right there with the troops. You're taking fire. Your cameraman deserves combat pay. People always talk about, well, Saving Private Ryan, the Normandy scenes are amazing. This leaves that in the dust. It's incredible because it's real. How do you go from a guy who says, I'm going to leave the CIA in 2011 to documentary filmmaker?
Sure. Well, look, I mean, the CIA is a place that you don't tell a lot of stories while you're working there, right. At least if you
And you never, if movies are right, you never truly leave.
And you never truly leave, of course. So the viewer can think what they want about that. But no, look, in any case, it is a place that's full of stories. So when I did leave it, and it's not just telling stories of what I saw, but it's really more about perspective. And I hope that's one thing that shines through in Mosul, is that really the difference with this film is hopefully people that watch it will sense, and certainly people that were there will understand this, that this is an informed and authentic portrayal of what actually happened. this is really what did happen. It's filmed first person. And that's a lot of feedback that we've gotten from people that were there said, I felt like I was there.
You seem to have had incredible cooperation with the Iraqi military, because there are some guys are wearing body cams, it seems like,
right,
running through the streets, taking sniper fire, not just there's a sniper off in the distance shooting at something. You know, there's a sniper shooting at them as they're making their way to try and get to the sniper.
Right.
How was working with the Iraqi government and trying to get this kind of access, or did you have to deal with the general? How does that work?
Well, it's interesting. The Iraqis learned a couple things from our time dealing with them over the last 15 years. And one of those is the importance of telling a story or a narrative about whatever military objective they're trying to accomplish. So in this case, at the time when the regime in Baghdad decided that they wanted to get serious and address the ISIS question, they recognized that there was a value to having media, controlled media though it may be, on the scene to tell the story of the Iraqi people coming together to defeat ISIS. And I don't think a lot of people in the West realize that, but certainly people in our military community would look at this film and see this as a successful narrative of the Iraqi people coming together, unifying the different sects, the different groups, and ultimately defeating ISIS with their own forces.
Part of the narrative in this country through the media was that the Iraqis were more mired in tribal strife than actually trying to be unified and fight an enemy like ISIS. Did you find that to be the case? And another misperception, I would say, based on this movie, is that their military is, you know what, when it going gets rough, they're kind of going to go home. They're not really interested in the fight. That's clearly not the case here. So talk a little bit about both of those, if you don't mind.
Well, the first part is absolutely true. So the sectarian strife and then the squabbling between tribes, if you will, That's what brought us ISIS. So there's no denying that. The lack of unity and lack of ability to see a common civil society between the Iraqi people is what led to the power vacuum that ultimately was filled by that ideological extremism that we saw. But in terms of the Iraqi military's professionalism, what you'll see in the film are units, the Golden Brigade.
I didn't know if they were Americans or not until they started talking, where you could really see the patches.
Yeah, there are no Americans in the film. There's a couple of American pieces of equipment. You'll see some 5.11 gear shirts, see Bad Boys spray painted on a Humvee. you'll see one guy wearing a USA hat. But there are no Americans in this film. There's not a word of English spoken in it. Except for the narrator. Narration has been translated to English. But really, the professionalism of the Iraqi units is going to stand out. And again, feedback from veterans is, wow, I trained those guys. I'm really proud of what they did. You'll see it in the way they move, in the way the way they're dressed, the way they act. Not all of the units, because don't forget, this wasn't just specifically a professional military force. This operation involved different tribes from varying levels of, from Minuteman level all the way up to special forces, right? So, I mean, there were Iranian-backed militias and Kurdish militias and Shia militias. It was a whole hodgepodge of different security forces that came together.
That's kind of how ISIS was able to grow. There was no one massive force against them. It was varying degrees of, I think, disinterested forces, depending on what ISIS happened to be attacking. The enemy of my enemy is my friend kind of thing. I'm not going to join them, but I'm certainly not going to fight them. I'm going to let them fight my enemies. Then there comes a time when the world, for large part, not completely, says we've got to deal with ISIS. Did we wait too long as a planet, really, to look at this scourge? Because while we've rid the Middle East of the caliphate, geographic terms, the ISIS ideology has metastasized. Because you interview an ISIS recruiter, I think he is, in the movie. And it's fascinating. But did we wait too long to take them seriously from a military standpoint? Politically, obviously, we did. But from a military standpoint?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no question about that. And it wasn't just the U.S. It was the Russians. It was Iran. It was all the governments of the region that just kind of collectively hoped that this problem would go away, or at most be contained to a part of Syria that was in open rebellion, or, the hinterlands of northern Iraq. But that wasn't the case. And, there were certainly those astute voices early on in the debate, throughout our involvement in Iraq that warned that this is exactly what would happen. And I think one element of the film is the question of what happens next. So while we are, withdrawn now and standing down, and this is not, a priority for our national security policy, there is a definite cautionary tale in this film about what could come next.
Can you ever fully defeat a group like ISIS, an ideology? The prisoner, the ISIS recruiter that you talk to, says basically, if I'm killed today, I've got four people ready to take my place right now. And it seems like you're playing a game of whack-a-mole against an ever-growing field.
Right.
And you're never going to have a big enough mallet.
Yeah, the ISIS detainees' words, I'm not a body and a place, I'm a soul and an ideology. Just chilling to hear him say it in the context that he says it in. That's how we end the film, and I did that on purpose because I want people to think about that as they walk out.
But as with your expertise and your experience over there, and the experience of making this documentary, and all the research that goes along with not only being a CIA counterterrorism guy, but a documentary filmmaker, can we defeat them? The Bush years, it was all about we got to get the hearts and minds, hearts and minds, hearts and minds. Didn't seem like we ever got the hearts or the minds. Is there merit to continuing down that path and still trying to beat your head against that wall? Or does there come a point where you just go, I'm out of here. You guys have to figure this out. If you want to be free, we've set you up for that. If you don't, then that's on you.
Yeah, well, I think the pendulum has swung in both ways now. And I think within maybe the next 2 years, we're probably going to find the middle ground to that question. There's no question that there's an element of hearts and minds that needs to be applied, because we can't kill all the terrorists. Mm-hmm. This is something Don Remsel talked about. Killing one terrorist creates five more. That's just the reality. I kind of liken it to kind of where we are in modern medicine with cancer, which is, you kind of look at a holistic approach. You recognize the importance of it. You fund it and you look at ways to defeat it and to treat it and to scale it back. But you know, the cure for cancer has proved elusive, but we don't give up the fight and we don't stop paying attention to it.
Right. But if you kill a cancer cell, you don't create four more, or we would change our approach. And I don't know. You can't not kill terrorists. Mm-hmm. You can't. They're evil people trying to kill innocent people. You have to take them out every chance that you get. But is it the way you described it? Sounds horribly self-defeating. Victory is a loss eventually, is what you're saying.
Well, you know, let's talk about the role of allies. So one thing is some of our allies, especially in that region, are frankly a lot better at killing terrorists than we are. Mm. They don't put them on an island in the Caribbean and leave them sit there for 15 years. They're much more
efficient. They force them to play soccer.
Well, so yeah, exactly.
That should be a violation of Geneva Conventions.
So, you know, it's the role of allies is something that we need to consider. And it goes back to what part of this fight is our fight and what part of this fight is their fight and what part is a larger, you know, question for mankind. And the balance is something that it's a very nuanced approach.
Are you hopeful?
I am hopeful, yeah.
I think, you know more than anybody listening. So if you're hopeful, then that gives me hope.
I'm hopeful, and not just from what you'll see in the movie, but from the people that I work with, including the people that I work with in this film and the people I work with all around the world, people that just literally want the same thing that you and I do, to be able to live in peace and raise your children and that sort of thing. So at the end of the day, that the humanity is something I hope shines through in the film, and it is a hopeful tale. It's also a cautionary tale, as I noted. But it does show that when people can communicate and align their interests, positive change can happen.
When people think about ISIS, really the Middle East, Muslim countries, they have a certain perception when it comes to women. I'm going to butcher this name, but I'm going to try to say it anyway and then let you correct me. There's I don't want to call her a character because she's a real person, but there's a person, a character in this documentary called Hanadi.
You got it
right.
I did it. Yeah. All right. Good job.
Is a woman who's a commander in the fight against ISIS. I was shocked to find that out because that is. I lived in Dearborn, Michigan during college, as I was telling you before this, and it wasn't uncommon to see the family walking down the street and the mother always, you know, 5-10 paces behind the father, the men kind of talking while the women sort of meandered and waited. That's what we think of as, you know, really orthodox Muslim countries. Tell us about because she blows that to hell.
Yeah, she blows a lot of things to hell, actually.
Yeah, I know, but so, I was going to let you say that.
Not just standing behind, you know, walking a couple steps behind the family. I mean, she is standing on top of a Jeep with binoculars calling in, you know, artillery strikes. So
she's a commander of a brigade.
She's a caricature. She's a character, but she, most importantly, she's a real person. Yeah.
It's not the most women friendly culture. How did she get into a position to have a militia? And how do they follow her with the culture that has been sort of ingrained in them?
Well, unfortunately, through her own tragedy, through her own personal tragedy of having two husbands, the latter one that was a military police commander in the region that was killed by ISIS. So there's a part of the film where she talks about the death of her husband and her love for her husband and how she retrieved his body from a minefield under fire. And the troops around her just saw this and were just mesmerized. And over the course of time, she ended up being the leader of a growing kind of ragtag militia group. And she was very effective doing it. She's a contradiction, though, because she's not only a Sunni, but she's fighting and leading a Shia militia. I mean, she's on, frankly, the Iranian payroll, that she's getting money from Iran, as a lot of these groups do. And that's a whole other element of the film that needs to be discussed. But she's a contradiction as well in the sense that she balances, you know, motherhood. She's got a young child that she introduces to us in the film. She's cooking, you know, stew in the kitchen, chicken stew, and then she's rebutting rumors that she may have cut the heads off ISIS fighters, which is some, you know, she told that to a CNN
crew. We've all had those kind of rumors spread about us.
What's the balance, right? Yeah. So just a terrific person and just really...
But an iron will and no fear at all. Just I found her absolutely fascinating because that is the exact opposite of what we're told. You know, in Saudi Arabia, just not that far from here, mm-hmm. women are now being able to drive. Well, is not worried about, she's not got a problem.
She doesn't need to drive. She has her own driver, and it's a guy, which is even, you know, she sits in the back seat, and she's the boss.
You alluded to this, that there are, it's strange bedfellows. Mm-hmm. Iran is throwing money around. The United States is throwing advice and tactical around. Every Russia is involved over there. Who are the good guys? Is it anybody who's against ISIS or what? Because Russia, Vladimir Putin doesn't get up in the morning and go, I really feel a moral obligation to humanity to help stamp out ISIS. The mullahs in Iran don't wake up and say that either. You can argue whether or not we do. I think we certainly can make a better case than most of the rest of the world. But who are the good guys? Are there good guys or are there just varying degrees of people we have to deal with?
Another central question of the film, and it really you see in this, the only true bad guys in this are ISIS, and the unity that comes from these different groups as they, as they single-mindedly converge on their objective is amazing. But the question then is, what are the other intentions and what are the elements of external influence and power that are taking place behind the scenes?
As a CIA guy, does it matter? When you look at it from a CIA analyst point of view, is it the enemy of my enemy is my friend and we'll sort the rest of it out later? Or do you have to play a dual track game the whole time?
I think there is a dual track game being played. And we hear that from the characters. All of the different people that are interviewed have their own takes. So the Sunnis talking about the Kurds, the Sunnis talking about the Shia, the Kurds talking about the Christians. They all, there's this moving kind of chessboard here that we see develop through the dialogue. And that really is that's the sequel. I mean, that's the future of the Middle East. That's the whole ballgame right there. What's next? Because I don't think it's going to be as simple as, guys all dressed in black with a black and white flag. And
right.
That's kind of like 2018, 17, 16.
When Saddam Hussein was alive and in charge of Iraq, the argument was there was peace. There was peace because if you disrupted the peace, you were killed. There was no way, two ways about it. So the tribal bitterness and rivalries were put on a back bench, because if you acted on them, all hell would break loose on you. Can they get along? Or do you think? I mean, they can when they have a common enemy,
right,
or when they have a common opponent or oppressor.
Or a heavy-handed dictator.
Yes. But you remove that. Do you think they can get along?
Well, I think that's where the external powers come into play. So they can, if they're not being manipulated by external forces, whether it's the Russians, Iran, Turkey. They all have their objectives that they're trying to accomplish. And unfortunately, as we see in this film, it's on the backs of the Iraqi people.
Places like Russia and places like Turkey, are their objectives more to mess with us using this as a method than it is that they really care about what's going on in Syria? Or, I mean, obviously for border issues and things like that, but in general, are they much more interested in sticking a thumb in our eye and causing us to stay longer, do more things, spend more money, or do they really actually have concerns about the issue, about the area and the people?
Well, look, I know self-interest and nationalism is kind of a loaded term these days, mm-hmm. but the fact of the matter is they have governments that are self-interested, and they're driven by realpolitik about making sure that their interests in the region, which they see this as their backyard, which it is, come first. So it's, they may not necessarily have any, hatred of America or our ideals like certainly ISIS does, but they have self-interest. And if they don't align with what we're trying to accomplish, they have no qualms about exerting theirs.
Lastly, Dan, in your documentary, you have amazing footage on the ground, firsthand accounts right there. We have a president. President is, I think, rightly celebrating the destruction of the caliphate. But I always warn against spiking the football on the 5-yard line. This seems like an endless, there's an infinity pool. This seems like an infinity football field. Is it safe to say definitively the caliphate is gone, ISIS is defeated? Or should we maintain our guard? Because we're not pulling out yet. There are a lot of people who would love to pull out now, bring everybody home. What would you say to people who are saying, we've done it? We've done it. It's time to come home.
Right. Well, I would caution against giving any mission accomplished speeches, for sure. I don't think that's where we're at. I think there's a danger to saying the caliphate is defeated. If you think the caliphate is a geographical place that holds land and runs county elections and sets the price of milk, yes, it's defeated. If you think it's an ideology, it's metamorphosizing into something else. So that's the danger. And that's going to be in Sri Lanka. That's going to be in Indonesia. That's going to be in places that we're not talking about in this film, and it can spread very easily to those places.
When you say it's metamorphosizing into something else, in the days of the internet, you can have a virtual country, you can have a virtual caliphate. Are you saying that looking forward, you can see more things like Sri Lanka, random attacks sort of inspired by ISIS, maybe even via the internet, but the caliphate is virtual and worldwide, not geographic? Is that what you're...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, ISIS was an idea that Baghdadi had kind of based in a geographical location, and the success of it was to rise and fall on holding, you know, Raqqa or Mosul, with different objectives and a different focus and a different emphasis. ISIS, you know, 2.0 or 3.0, whatever version we're on now, could be something that we're really not prepared to deal with. It's not going to be something that's geographical based.
Tell us where people can find out about the movie. I know it's on iTunes. Give out the URL. Give out if it's, you know, on Amazon.
Yeah,
or wherever
easiest
else
place, iTunes or Amazon. But I mean, it's literally available everywhere online. You can download it. You can buy DVD or Blu-ray, Target, Walmart, Amazon. But iTunes is probably the easiest place.
The website is Mosul, Mosul-film.com. Check out the trailer. I mean, I'll embed the trailer in this post too. So if you're listening on iTunes or whatever, go to the website, dailycaller.com, find this post and check out the trailer. Dan, congratulations on the movie. Much success. You're touring around the country. Are you going to be anywhere anytime soon? You want to tell anybody?
We don't have any plans right now. We just wrapped up a premiere in Tampa and Charleston, but we'll be looking at some stuff later in the summer. So we'll definitely keep you posted.
Go to Mosul-film.com. Dan Gabriel, director, executive producer, and possibly maybe award winner. We shall see. Congratulations, and thanks for coming.
Appreciate
in.
It.
There you have it. Two great interviews, three great guests, one awesome hour, and an amazing set of ears loaned to me by you. It's Black Friday. It's a holiday weekend. Hopefully your weekend is filled with family that just can stand to be around. And even if not, if there's an annoying cousin or somebody there, think of them as a potential organ donor in a pinch and make sure you don't tick them off. Have a wonderful weekend. We'll be back with regular programming on Monday. Now go eat a turkey sandwich.